this is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another episode. Glad to have you with me. Today we are recording episode 198, believe it or not. We may have to publish 198 ahead of the other episodes that we've put on the queue right now, but because we've got a bit of you'll hear all about it during the conversation right now. So it's a scheduling thing. But 198 episodes, we started mid-2023. Thanks for all your support. We're doing well. Our viewership is going up, and the support that I have from you, I'm so grateful for everything that you guys give me, from compliments, sharing, commenting on the content. I really appreciate it. Today, I have a distinct pleasure and honor to welcome to the conversation Lori Thick. Lori, welcome to the channel.
Thank you very much, Robin. I'm really excited to be here. You've got such an incredible following, and thank you for inviting me.
I really appreciate it. And by the way, welcome to Toronto. I know you ordinarily live in southern France. Now we catch you in Toronto, and I can't wait to see you on April 8th. We'll talk about the book launch in a second. Lori, as we say on this channel, everybody's got a story. Why don't we start with this one, just to break the ice for you and for the audience, to get to know you a little bit better. What's your story? What got you here?
Oh my goodness, it's a really long, long story. And I wouldn't know where it began, but I can tell you what we're here to talk about. Well, so many things. The book, Translators Without Borders, the localization industry. I think I got here when my farmhouse, the farmhouse we lived in when I was 14, burned down. That's how I got here. We were living in a mining town in Northern Ontario, and the day the farm burned down, my father realized that he hadn't paid the fire insurance. It had expired 3 weeks earlier. So that's when the adventure began, because it really was an adventure. We'd lost everything and were essentially homeless. So that just opened up all of the doors in life. And my father's attitude was that losing the farm meant now we were free. Losing everything. And I think he was right. And that really did change my life.
And you know, for the audience, again, you know, just to, for those of us who are not necessarily familiar with the localization industry, we've got a brand new viewers every week we get on this channel, brand new viewers. Just to frame it a little bit for who Lori is a Canadian author and a founder, born in Toronto, raised in Kirkland Lake, mining town, Northern Ontario, as Lori was mentioning earlier. Lori has a master of fine art from UBC, moved to Paris at the age of 25, founded Lexalera in 1986, Translators Without Borders in 1993 with Roz Smith Thomas, now lives in Southern France. She is also an ATC Outstanding Contribution Award winner in 2017 also. Now, When people in the localization world hear your name, they think Translator Without Borders, obviously. But Dreamer's Daughter, that's the name of your book, that's the title of your book, takes us somewhere completely different. The mining town in Northern Ontario and the road trip across Canada with the father who dreamed bigger than his circumstances. Where do you even begin to tell this story?
These are tough questions. But there is actually a straight line between those two, a line beyond the fact that my father's values that he gave me was that it was important to help be helpful in the world. But the other straight line is just being able to see things that don't exist yet. When we lost our house and we set off on a road trip across the country, you had to, and my father had no money, no income. He had a little bit of money, but not very much, like the value of a pickup truck that he sold in post-dated checks. So being able to dare to do that and believe that it's all going to work out is a little bit behind everything, I guess, in my life. Just like coming to Paris, being able to leap and trust that you're going to land on something solid.
You know, we have something in common, and I didn't tell too many people about this, but I'm going to tell you this. We all go through episodes in our early childhood that define who we are as we grow up. And as we become adults in life, I grew up in civil war in Beirut, Lebanon. When I was a young kid, I was at the age of 7 when the war started. And I had to fend for myself at that age, I guess. Now, when I look at what happened in your life in Kirkland Lake and, you know, a gold rush town, you know, your mother abandoned you and your brother, Brad, you were 10, your brother at the age of 5, and leaving a father who is now supposed to be a single father for both kids and try to provide for them. You became the adult in the room. How did you do that? I'll tell you my story after you tell me yours.
I didn't have any choice, and you probably didn't either. You step into the breach. My father would never have said that I was the adult, except that it was like I was always going behind him and making sure, for example, that the rent got paid. Things that he thought weren't important as the adult in the room, I did think were really important. And so it was necessity. And your story?
So my story is, the war started at the age of 7. I was living in the same place where people being told in southern Lebanon right now to move. We did move. And we ended up back in the capital, in Beirut. And the war took over from there, and it stayed on and on and on and on forever. So I am the oldest in a group of 5 of us. My siblings and I were 5 kids. I'm the oldest. And I had to become a man at the age of teenager. Like as soon as I turned 10 years, I now have to figure out a way to, my father is not home. He is working, not because he's not home, because he's working. He's employee of the government at the time, so he's rarely home. So I'm supposed to do things on my own with my mom and my other siblings. One example, my father bought a sewing machine to the house, and he taught me how to use it at the age of 10. I was making sweaters. My mom, we used to make them in pieces, so my mother would stitch them and make them into a full sweater, sleeves and collars and whatever. And I used to take the weekend to go out and sell them. And my job, it was on the weekend not to come back home with any sweaters.
Wow. And at the same time, there was a war going on, right?
At the same time, there was a war.
And you had to worry about where the bombs were falling, where it was safe, how to get food.
Now, you mentioned in your book, your father was trying to be an entrepreneur or a dreamer, as you call it. Tell me a little bit more about that one. What kind of an entrepreneur did he try to be, and he failed? Obviously, but per the book.
Thing that was just normal and solid, it didn't appeal to him. It had to be something that was going to strike it hugely rich. For example, one time he came up with the idea of liquid manure. He thought that, quite correctly, I'm sure, that city dwellers wouldn't want a bag of horse manure on their balconies, but horse manure is the best fertilizer. So he came up with a plan to filter the rainwater through manure piles horse racing neighbor of his, and filled this liquid into glass bottles. It was really a good fertilizer, and he called it Dax Liquid Gold. It sold out in nurseries all over southern Ontario, and these bottles, tightly capped, were sometimes put in the display windows. It was his biggest success to that point. The only problem was some of those bottles were sitting in sunlight, and the methane inside them was growing and growing and growing until all of a sudden the bottles exploded all over southern Ontario. All over, store floors were covered in this liquid manure. So my dad told me that story, and I was like, well, God, Dad, what happened next? And he said, well, your mother and I had to move out of town. And there are so many of my father's stories that end up with things burning up or exploding. It just never is a normal way of a business not working and winding down. I mean, I could tell you so many stories like that.
Now, Dacre sees, regarding the house fire, he sees it as, and Dacre is your father's name, Dacre Thick, mm-hmm. just for the audience, so we know what we're talking about or who we're talking about. May he rest in peace if he passed. House fire, Dacre sees it as a freedom, not a catastrophe. And here we go on a cross-country trip in a home wheel. Like, I'm assuming it was a trailer with a mobile home attached to it or something.
No, it was a Volkswagen van. That's why it's on my cover. Just a Volkswagen van, yeah.
That's the exact one?
And it had a hole rusted in the... No, it wasn't, but it's the same color and model.
It's the same color, yeah, okay.
Rusted in the floorboard, and you know the hole. The whole thing.
So... How did you, and I had to go through this in my life because I'm the oldest of 5, but your brother Brad and yourself on a road trip in a Volkswagen van, how did you, and I'm assuming you had to fend for yourself and for your brother and manage your father, and how did that work out for you, cross country?
Well, bearing in mind, I'm a teenager, and this is a period when we all hitchhike. We hitchhiked across the country, and we stopped at youth hostels. That's what people did in the 70s. So I'm a teenager and I realized that more boys hitchhike than girls and they stay at youth hostels. So I talked my father into staying at youth hostels, which at the time was $2.50 a night. But of course, I would never let him inside. So he would sleep outside in the van with my brother and I would sleep in the youth hostel. And his generous nature just absolutely got the better of him because they're all backpackers. Everybody's backpacker except for me, who's traveling with my father, the only one. And he saw these kids were like hungry for a good meal. So he started, despite our limited resources, he started cooking the meals on the back of the Volkswagen van on a Coleman stove. And it got to the point where it's the same groups going across the country and they get a ride this far, that far. And it got to the point where people were expecting my father to roll into the youth hostel and cook them dinner. And as we went across the country, by the time we got to Banff, his reputation was solid. And then it got out of hand, totally out of hand. There were 40 people. He was making spaghetti sauce and we took it over and took it to the park and put it on a park bench, his Coleman stove and the spaghetti sauce in one pan and the spaghetti in the other. And Brad and I were to dole it out. And there was a fight in the lineup. People were fighting to get into the lineup to get this spaghetti. And he went off to take care of the fight and break it up. And Brad and I are trying to control a bunch of hungry hippies who want the food and they're only supposed to take a little bit so it'll go. They started taking more and, oh man, I got to feed my dog. It was so out of control. By the time my father finished breaking up the fight, all the food was gone and there was still a lineup for it. So I said, okay, Dad, that's enough. No more, no more. We're not going to do this anymore. So we got the rest of the way to British Columbia without any incident.
So tell me, what does Brad do now? Is he in Canada? Is he traveling? What is he?
Well, I think it's really interesting what Brad does, actually. You didn't know that before you asked the question, but we never had a solid home. We never had a usual home. What he does is he builds homes. He builds beautiful homes for people.
Is he in the area?
He's in Kelowna.
He's in Kelowna.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I really appreciate that. I can appreciate that. And I've said this story before on another podcast. I was interviewed on another podcast where I told this story about in my teen years. We got bombed so much in just outside of Beirut. I had to figure out, and I never done this before in my life. I say, how do you figure this out at 10 years? To build a bunker behind the house. And I built a bunker behind the house, which is still standing till today.
Really? Well, it was a good bunker.
I didn't know. Like, I mean, I got a friend of mine who drive a dozer. We dug a hole. We start putting cast concrete in and, you know, layers of concrete on the roof. And it seems to withstood the test of time, a test of not just time, a test of other things too. So it seems to still be there. But the things, going back to your earlier comment, it seems to, you jump through the breach. You're right.
Yeah.
You walk the door open, whatever that is, and you just have to figure it out. You get your parachute on your way down.
Yep. You just have to rise to the occasion. My occasion was not as serious as your occasion, though. I mean, you were rising to a war.
Yeah, but you know, these things happen and I'm not the only one and I'm not considering myself special because of it. And I know you have construction on the other side. Don't worry about it. We'll get that done. Don't worry. These things are live conversations. These things do happen from time to time. It's not a big deal. This is not a Joe Rogan kind of a style here. We're just doing what we can with the tools that were provided to us and the lovely conversation we're having.
And given our backgrounds, we are rolling with the punches because that's what
we're rolling doing. With the punches. Absolutely. Now, you had a CBC prizes and Canada Council of the Grant early on, and you got like the, I think it was BC Most Talented. What kept the writing dream alive, you know, through the decades of building businesses and charity work? But you kept, I'm assuming because of the book is just coming out and we're going to go together, celebrate the launch on the 8th. What kept that writing going on in your mind that I still want to be an author?
I actually lost it, Robin. I lost it for a long time. And despite those prizes, I always had like a reason. Well, that's because, I don't know, I had a good topic, or I always had a reason for those prizes. I didn't really actually believe in them. And I think that that's why I let the writing go, because I didn't believe in myself. Yeah, it might sound strange, but it's true. And doing business was something I knew how to do. I had done it from a young age. I've seen my father. I saw my father in all permutations.
Yeah, yeah. Don't worry about the construction. Just continue.
Taught me he taught me everything he knew about business, and it was sort of in my blood. So that in a way was easier, and I didn't have to deal with, you know, writing is really, you're really putting yourself out there, and very much a way business was easier for me.
That's right. And you know what? I may come back to you and ask you, like after the podcast, I'd love to ask you your opinion on, I'm writing a book too about my memoir. And people told me like for many years, Robin, you should write them down. Because I got thousands of these stories. You don't go through what I went through unless you collect some memories out there.
Yeah,
but,
I think you should.
But it must be, you know, this, like the old saying that says we're a product of our own environments. And so, you know, if you grew up in certain environment, you develop to be a different person than other people who develop in other types of environments. So you went to Paris to write a novel, ended up building a translation company, L'Excellera. And what was the moment you realized language was the business, not just the medium?
Oh my goodness. That was a really good time when I moved to Paris. And first of all, I was already a book editor when I went to graduate school. So I was already in words and language at the time, 1986. I just think this is so interesting. Translators were like these artists because they only had typewriters. Nobody could correct them. Nobody could touch their work. And when I arrived, it was the very first computers. It was Amstrad. So...
Well, I remember Amstrad. Oh my God, yeah. Amstrad? That's what I learned on.
Yeah. So that was 86. And so that meant you could improve on translations. And that meant also, it just created a whole new way of looking at the business. The customers could have quality that didn't have spelling mistakes or using their terminology. And so when I got into the business, it was a really good moment. And it was quite easy to grow that. If my father had only been in a business that was that easy to grow.
So the company's been around for 40 years almost, and still there. Can you give us an idea what it does and what are you specialized in?
Well, we moved into this again as my father, because he could see things that nobody else could see. And now everybody is talking machine translation. When we started doing machine translation, people were saying, I mean, the whole entire industry, except for a few people, were saying machine translation is 5 years away from being ready, and it always will be. So the company had a technology bent right at the you know, really at the beginning. And we were at the beginning of machine translation. I didn't have the huge resources behind me, like we localized us, for example. So I didn't grow the company that big, mm-hmm. but we always use technology in I hope a smart way.
And so, you know, one of the things in the industry, which I'm used to now, is that skepticism when it comes to technology. And obviously with machine translation in your world, you've faced enough skepticism from everybody around you.
I did.
But you took it on early on in the, and I remember those conversations early on back in the days of logos and many other early on type of technologies that came along. And believe it or not, like back then people were still dictating, you know, using the dictation to do the translation. So they speak it to a voice machine and then somebody would transcribe that. And it was a long, you know, process. But what gave you conviction that technology is the way to go? I mean, that's early on. Fast forward till today, that's a completely different discussion.
Yeah, I know. I can't explain it. But if I have a skill from my father, it's being able to see things that don't exist yet.
Because it seems to me early, I mean, I don't know, but this is just me saying now what we know today reflects back on what we thought, you know, we knew back then. There was a lot of content to be translated, but not enough translators to translate it. And I'm talking globally. Of course, it varies per language combination. And probably because of that, I think people was trying to figure out, well, like using a calculator for an accountant. Why do I need to do the math in my head if I can use a calculator to help me do the accounting a little bit better? I think that what drove, and up till today still, that's what's driving people innovation in our language industry. I don't know if you share the same opinion.
I think it's a good impulse. You're right. Why do the math in our heads? It may have consequences that we're not prepared for or don't really want, but that horse is already out of the barn. You know what I mean? Translators definitely have a different job.
But the genie's out of the bottle.
Yeah, is that how, that's the expression. So they have a different job now, and not all of them wanted that job. You know, as post editors.
Now, you founded your first company at the age of 12. You don't know how much research I've done on you, but I did my homework.
I know, now I do.
You founded your first company at the age of 12. So is Dacher in that entrepreneurial instinct or despite him?
No.
And tell me about that. Tell me a little bit about that. Tell the audience about that venture back then.
My first business was selling Christmas trees in Northern Ontario, which is a land covered by Christmas trees. Literally is covered by Christmas trees.
It's like selling ice to Eskimos. Is that what they say?
Absolutely.
I shouldn't have probably used that, but anyway.
And but my father helped me, obviously, and he cut down the trees and I sold them in a garage lot in places where it's 40 degrees below zero. So it was pretty cold. But the idea that I could do that and make money was just like, wow. There were a couple of points where I had more money than my father did. We were fairly poor, even before our house burned down. We were fairly poor because he was always, not in the next big scheme.
Tell me, what was your first break?
My first break was really having the father I had, honestly. To have someone who believes in you, I think that's the most important break a person can have, a child can have anyway.
And in business, what was your first break?
Did I have a break? I made a break.
I'm assuming it starts with education. You probably got like good education at UBC and you found your way from there. Is that how it worked for you?
Well, yes, also, but I worked two jobs to pay for my education. And I'm lucky that I'm Canadian and that there was a good system for people going to university back then.
Yeah.
That was a good break. It doesn't exist today. People without an income would really have a hard time. When it wasn't that hard for me back in the day.
Let's talk a little bit about a transition without border. We're trying to address all the high levels today, so if you don't mind. So tell me, what is the origin story? Médecins Sans Frontières, perhaps?
That's exactly it. I'd always wanted to do something in a volunteer basis, but life, how it is. Life carries on, you're too busy, and I never had the time. I literally didn't. Meant to do so many things and I did it. Then one day, Médecins Sans Frontières came to my office and asked for a quote on a translation project that they had. And a little light went off and I thought, hold on, if we don't charge you, because I love Médecins Sans Frontières, they're one of the best organizations.
Yeah.
So I thought, if we don't charge you, can you use the money in the field? And they said, absolutely, they could use the money that they would normally spend on the translation. That was the beginning of everything. What was surprising to me is I think the first few translations we paid the translators ourselves, but afterwards translators also wanted to find a way that they could volunteer and do something that's in their field and yet is helpful to the world. And so we had just a tremendous success with a lot of volunteer translators.
So instead of writing a check, you decided to do a donation in the form of a service. Is that?
Yes, absolutely. Good? And we had project managers in the office who managed it, and the translators themselves were freelancers who volunteered their time. It was a great machine. You know what happened is that was 1993. Worked for a lot of nonprofits. We couldn't really even raise our profile because too many nonprofits needed help. So what happened was Haiti, the earthquake in 2010. Yes. So a lot of our nonprofits were involved in the rescue and they needed translations around the clock. And two things I discovered. First of all, the first thing is that we were running up against the limit of what we could do, even as project managers, even within my company, how much could we handle as project managers with this enormous need for translation. That was the first realization that we needed technology to scale. We needed technology so badly to scale. Second realization was that the European languages weren't the only ones that were needed. I mean, yourself, if you're going into Beirut in even French, which is widely spoken, you're not going to reach the people who need the help the most. And that's when we realized, we have a bigger problem than we were addressing. That's when I took Translators Without Borders to a new level.
So that was the catastrophe of the earthquake in Haiti that propelled it to the next level because, hey, there is a need. I can't do it on my own. I need to reach out and take this thing a little wider than what you were doing on your own with your company. Am I correct?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, so we've talked about the elephant in the room, which is translation. The misinformation kills, I would say, as surely as a disease in some cases.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, truly.
Can you give our listener a concrete example where language access costing lives?
Well, there's so many examples. Well, I mean, in a catastrophe, if people don't understand where to go, first of all, they could go the wrong way. When there were the boats coming into Greece, people were misunderstanding. There were volunteers on the shore ready with blankets to help them. But they couldn't speak the same language, and the people became afraid and didn't land where they would have been taken care of and went back out to the wild and dangerous seas. Just for one example, in Haiti, where people were trying to get the message out about the drinking water, which was transmitting cholera, that message also, because it wasn't in Haitian Creole, wasn't getting through. Again, lives are lost.
And I did a, there's another one too, like it's very interesting because I did a couple of episodes on cybersecurity, and the topic right now is the human brain being the attack surface. And it used to be system attack. Now we're attacking the how the human think and changing minds, changing behaviors, changing perspective on things.
Oh my God, yeah.
One of the technologies we talked about in one of the episodes, it was the newly launched Apple AirPods, I guess they call them, the one that you put in your, I'm not an Apple guy, so the earphones that you put in your ear, and the capability of that device to scan 32 types of human emotions, DNA, temperature, blood pressure, everything else, and build a database on each individual. Now, the possibility is there to do that. Are they doing it? I have no idea, but the possibility of collecting information and replaying back that information to the human in the way they see or the way somebody wants to play it back, either remarketing to them or some other fashion. So that entire language concept of misinformation, especially when you take it on a global level, like if you take it on a two language combination, it's okay and you can manage that. But when you're dealing with like hundreds of language combination, that becomes a monster of a problem to fix. Now, when you look back, you know, you're still involved with Transition Without Border, Translators Without Border. It's been 30 years strong and you're still involved there. 100,000 linguists strong. I guess that's what the number that I've seen, a little bit more than that or less, or 200 now.
200,000 now.
There you go.
I'm very peripherally involved. It's really being managed by the team that's been managing it since, I don't even know, very close to 2010. Amy Ansari is the executive director, and it's being managed by a big team of people now. It's become a very big force in humanitarian aid. Oh yeah, so 200,000 linguists.
Does it feel like a miracle?
Well, it is incredible. It is incredible.
Oh, it's a major
it's definitely
achievement.
Grown, but it's grown beyond me. And that's fine. That's fine. It's like a parent. I mean, that's what we want, just for our children to grow.
What does that tell you about the industry, Lori?
Oh my God. That there's that many volunteers from our industry. It's an industry that is full of heart, for sure.
Because I don't see that from other industries. I mean, I'm sure they have their own charities. I get that. I understand that. You know, but I don't see 200,000 volunteers doing things for free for other people in other industries.
Yeah. And I don't mean to be mean about one industry.
No, I'm not being mean. I'm just stating a fact.
Like you don't hear, you know, bankers, that many volunteers in the banking industry, for example. I think that they're especially, I don't know, people.
And by the way, my message to the bankers, volunteering at United Ways is one thing, but what we're talking about here is giving away the product that these individual translators are selling themselves. So if you want to equate that in the banking industry, that would be as the banking industry giving away mortgage and loans and for free to others. And I don't know if they do that, but that's a good idea. You should start there.
One, just from the early days, I remember translators would work all day translating, put the kids to bed, and then they would start translating for Translators Without Borders. It's a pretty interesting group.
That's very awesome gesture from the industry to the rest of the world. And, you know, I speak three languages, and every time I feel that there is somebody who's having a hard time communicating, I feel for them, because when I first came to Canada in 1990, I told the story yesterday, landed in Fredericton, New Brunswick, 19th of February, 1990, in the middle of a blizzard, whiteout. I just couldn't see outside. In any case, I did not speak English and I spoke French and Arabic. And, you know, I had to learn and learn quickly. Otherwise, you know, I wouldn't have been able to survive or do the things that I ended up doing in life. So language is the blood of life, I think.
Yeah.
And it's nothing new here. I mean, this is historically goes back to the Babylonians and, you know, goes back into, you know, all the other civilizations that went before us. Language is what bind together as a humanity. And I keep talking about we build connections by understanding each other's languages. And that's what Translation Without Borders is trying to do here. So you've helped build the first African language on Microsoft Bing, Swahili for 150 million people. If I'm getting this wrong, tell me. This that is staggering. What does equal access information look to you in actuality?
That's the thing that is so important. And Swahili is the tip of the iceberg. You know,
correct,
there are so many languages and languages where literally tens and hundreds of millions of people speak the language and they don't have access to the kinds of things that we have access to. For example, more kids die from diarrhea in India than from any other cause. And that's just a question of information. They don't realize that the treatment they need is water, salt, sugar. That is plain and simple. They're not getting the information they need. And you can just multiply that by thousands of languages and by hundreds of different medical, not even information about how to start a business, optimize your crops. We're literally built. I'm looking around me in Toronto at all these skyscrapers. We're literally built on knowledge. And that knowledge is siloed in the main languages, the main European languages, mostly.
100%. And you're absolutely correct, because if you look at the entire translation industry, of the language industry in general, if you look to say, well, where are we placing the emphasis? It seems to be placing the emphasis, the 80-20 rules. Every industry has them, I'm assuming. The translation industry is the epitome of the 80-20, 80% of the effort at the top 20 language combinations. And the rest of the language combinations, they do get importance, of course, but within reasons, I would say, because either A, if you look at the A, and we'll talk about AI in a second, if you look at the data available, look at the resources available, and we don't want to start talking about the languages that they're eroding and they're no longer being spoken in some cases, preserving languages from, you know, these are humanity heritage. You can't say, oh, this language is eroded. Well, tough luck. We'll get another one. It just doesn't work that way. We got the technology right now. It's just like building that capsule, that time capsule, to preserve these languages and not, and prevent them from being disappeared.
Otherwise, it's the way it is now with shopping. Every city you go to, no matter where, there's a Zara, you know, a Gap. They're all the same stores, and we're going to get homogenized if we lose our languages.
That's right. So we either speak 2-3 languages and that's it, or 5 languages. That's it. So you are going to be at Vamos, I hear?
Yes, I am. I'm really excited about that in Colombia this year. And I'm going to talk about living with purpose. We talked about how much caring and humanity there is in the translation industry. And I want to talk about that and finding ways to balance our work life with our dreams and our passions, and finding meaning in what we do.
So you are going to be the keynote, I hear. And so I have a question for you on this one. If looking back, if your late father, Dacre, was still alive sitting in the audience, what do you think he would say at the end?
It's my daughter.
I love that.
He'd be poking people. That's my daughter. See that? Yeah.
Do you reflect on that sometimes?
I would feel worse about the book coming out and him not living to see it, except that he always kind of believed in me. And so it's not like he wouldn't be surprised.
He would expect that from you? He would expect that from you, right? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So you had your own, what we're talking about earlier on in your life, you had your own struggle. You were a single mother running Lexcelera, Translators Without Borders, raising your son. That's not a small feat. This is a lot of effort. Where did the fuel come from? What do you run on?
I don't even
think. You have a diet regimen? Like, how does that work?
Well, I think the bad thing is that I had that example. My dad was a single father. So in a way, I wish I hadn't had that example, because it just seemed normal. And I don't think it should seem normal. I think it would have been nicer if I'd arranged things differently. And my son did actually have a dad in the house doing all the dad things. But so it just seemed very normal to me. And also, I'm used to doing everything. I hate to say it like that, but I'm just used to doing things.
And where's your son now? What does he do?
My son, I'm so proud of him. He's a psychologist. He's 29 years old and he already has patients, and he works at the leading psychiatric hospital in Paris. And he's in the psychological wing, and he's a really nice guy. I did something right. I did something right.
This is very good. That's very good. Congratulations. And is there anything or something about growing up the way you did, with very little stability, but a lot of love, that made you unusually tolerant of risk as an entrepreneur?
Oh, yeah. Well, risk that I can control. That's somehow what it taught me. that I need to manage it, and then I'm okay. I couldn't invest to save my life because I don't have control of that. But with the business, I never had any sense of risk because I felt like the levers were in my hand. And if they failed or didn't fail, it was up to me. So it never felt risky. In fact, I read something, an Ernst & Young study of entrepreneurs, and it said, I can't remember all the characteristics, but it said literally 100% of entrepreneurs are optimistic. And I think that's the main, it's true. It's a main, you have to believe that it's going to work or you'd never do it.
It's like jumping and figure out where the parachute is. That has to be your DNA.
Yeah.
Your DNA.
Yeah, I hadn't heard that one, but yeah.
So let's, you know, every one of those episodes nowadays, when we do a recording, we have to talk about AI because it's there. It's there and everybody talks about it. So let's have a conversation about this one. Well, for the audience who are interested in your opinion, what you think. So you were an MT evangelist before most industry believed in such technology. Now generative AI is rewriting everything we do. Do you feel vindicated, worried, or both?
No, I feel more worried than anything, honestly. I didn't think of it getting out of hand as much as it has, if you know what I mean. I saw it as a tool to really rationalize the work of translators. I didn't foresee it taking over the work of translation.
You didn't foresee it taking
over? And
that's
my fear. That's my fear.
Yeah. So in which way you did not think it would be taking over the work of the translator? I'm assuming you believe that the translators are what they do, the professional contribution they do to the language or they provide to the language industry is irreplaceable. That's very admirable. But in anything in life, I'm assuming there'd be some sort of a way to do things faster, better, and or maybe different. If it's the same, produce more quantities.
I think it's going to be like music where we, in fact, lowered our expectations. That's what I'm afraid is going to happen, whereas we lower our expectations for quality. For example, one thing I've noticed about translators is virtually any one of them is a writer. They're writers. They are literally making beautiful words, sentences, and paragraphs. They're writers. There's no question in my mind that they could pivot to that career if that wasn't also in danger. So AI can't, I really don't think it'll ever be that good because it still has this. So I don't think it will replace translators 100%, but I think that will lower our standards for what kind of quality we're expecting.
So just to counter that, a lot of researchers out there are saying it is improving as opposed to a static software that we've downloaded before, like TMS and all that stuff. And we had to wait for the next version of that software to come out so we can deploy it, et cetera. These models are improving on a day-to-day basis. I don't go a day without opening my laptop and figuring out, okay, what's new now? Which one launched a new model or revision of the new model, of the old model that they have? And the old model now, you would say it's 7 days old in some cases because these revisions are being implemented on the fly. Is there a timeline to some of these statements and what would be
I
like?
I don't know. It's just that for me, AI has only one voice. And you can spot it in an instant, whether it's on a Facebook post or even in an article. It only has one voice. So I'm not sure how it will be able to be a million different voices. That is what makes the beauty of literature.
Yeah, look, I mean, I completely agree with you. I mean, I translators are artists by definition, and like any writer and anybody out there that create things in a very creative way, I should say. And I do remember, you know, a lot of times these translators, they will take their time, they will perfect the text as if they were writing the next novel, if you will, which is admirable, professional. That's what they're supposed to do. Make sure that they do what they do is perfect. When you marry this with the commercial pressure, you create a different formula for the, like if we were to think about our entire industry from a language perspective in the context of we want to do something perfect. We want to do something very high quality. There's one way to look at it, but there's a different way of looking at it with the commercial pressure being applied to everything we do nowadays, right? If we were left on our, and I remember this conversation with the previous manager who used to run, the job manager used to run the first company I worked for in the language industry. He walked into the translator. He says, okay, Picasso, you've been working on this piece of translation for a day or two, the customer is yelling at me. Can you give me the translation? The translation. I was standing by him. Now, there is a joke aside. There is a huge advantage for professional translators. they bring a lot to the table. They bring that humanity, that technology and machines, it's learning now, maybe perfects over 10 years from now, I don't know. But it's not there yet. I agree with you. But there's a huge, and if you combine that, if you marry that with the content growth that we're seeing, I'm sure you're seeing that as well. You know, the content we used to create 20 years ago, the level of content, it was not the same that we are right now. We quadrupled this. We, you know, 10x'd it in some cases. So something had to give.
Yeah, I know. And maybe it's inevitable.
Now, if you were to think about the technology where it is right now and Translators Without Borders from a mission perspective, do you think it would help? It would solve? Do you still see that the Translators Without Borders mission will stay the same? Would it help them?
Yeah, that's where the rubber hits the road. It really would help as engines are being developed on smaller amounts of languages. For the languages that we don't have a lot of content for, those are also the people who are lacking the most drastically in access to information. So yeah, it would really help. I mean, I would love every mother in the world to have access to the same information I had as a mother. Raising a child, I just had access to so much information. It's really unfair. If, for example, breastfeeding, that's something that I know is really important. In a lot of cultures, that message just hasn't gone through. Nestle got through first, and they're saying bottle is best, and impoverishing families, impoverishing the health of children, just simply for access to knowledge. And if that information, because everybody now has a cell phone, is really, really, really common. If we could make that kind of information available to mothers everywhere in a language they understand, we're making the world a way better place.
You are working on a novel now, Lori, after a memoir. What pulls you toward fiction?
Well, okay, this is something that I will tell you in our off conversation about memoir writing. It's not that easy to sell a memoir if you're not famous. So just as a general, even though I'd love to write a sequel and would if pressed, but really it should be a lot easier to write fiction. And my novel is about what we're talking about today. It's about finding purpose, although it's about finding purpose at my age. It's about after you've done all the things that are useful to society as a working person, then how do you find your purpose in life and how do you make the rest of your days meaningful?
So
trying
now
to put that in an interesting context with romance
I love the idea. You can't sell memoir unless you're famous. And I hope, you know, your book, Dreamer's Daughter, be a success for you. And if Dreamer's Daughter reach one person who is right now in the middle of a chaotic childhood or a messy season in their life, what do you want them to take from the Dacher story and from yours, in that matter?
I went through some messy times. And I really would love someone who's in the middle of teenage rebellion and drugs and also not respecting yourself enough, as happens quite often with young girls. Geez, I'd like them to understand that there is something on the other side of this. You can get out of this and you can be who you want to be, who you make yourself to be.
I really appreciate your time with me. And I want to mention to the audience that just if you haven't noticed yet, you know, Lori and I, we grew up Canadians. We built our career in the language industry from the ground up. And she wrote a book about her experiences when she was growing up. And you can keep an eye on my book that is coming up, From the Ashes of Beirut to the Boardroom. And hopefully that resonate with some people. And I want to make sure that everybody is familiar with Lori Thick and her book, Dreamer's Daughter. There will be a launch going on Toronto on April 8th, but we'll provide all the links and all the other stuff in the credential in the descriptions of the post that we're going to be doing after this recording. Lori, is there anything that I haven't covered in this conversation that you liked the audience to know?
When is your book coming out?
I'm hoping by the end of the year.
Oh my God, that is really exciting. So that I wanted to cover. I can't wait to read it.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you so much. And I want to thank you for being part of this conversation, Lori. It was a great pleasure to have you on the channel.
Thank you very much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks a lot. And for the audience. And you know what? You're welcome back to the channel anytime. Hopefully we'll meet you at the next book. Or if you have anything else you want to tell the audience, consider the channel your home. And anytime you want to come back, you're very welcome.
Thanks.
And for the audience, I want to thank you so much for listening in. If you're coming on YouTube, thanks for watching us. If you're coming on the audio channels, Thanks for listening in. And if you're reading us on the blog, thanks for subscribing. I really appreciate it. And until next time, this is Robin Ayoub and Lori Finn signing off.
Bye. Thank you.